Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So who was Ty Cobb? Our guest this hour has written a book that's been receiving a lot of attention, Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. He had a pretty amazing life. I mean, it reads like a movie at some point, and there has been a movie made and a lot written about Ty Cobb. And I've heard our guests say that he fully anticipated coming up with more and more stories about what a super rat this guy was, but he found some things that made him question what had been said and written about Ty Cobb in the previous years, and there were many, many years. Charles Learson is our guest, and his book is, with a great picture of Ty Cobb on the front, who looks like he's about to fly, Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. Charles has written for Sports Illustrated, Esquire, Rolling Stone, Newsweek, The New York Times Magazine. He's the author of Blood and Smoke, A True Tale of Mystery, Mayhem, and the Birth of the Indy 500, and Crazy Good, The True Story of Dan Patch, the most famous horse in America. Although there may be another tomorrow. You never know. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hi, Charles.
Hey, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well.
Well, it's a fascinating story. This guy had quite a life. I want to start with something that has stayed with me, and you've written about it, because I can't imagine this happening. Let's start with the discussion of his father's murder. I think Ty Cobb was only 18 years old, and you say that a number of facts and considerations that haven't seen daylight since the tragedy you have written about in this book. There are a million questions after, but what a thing to have happen, and what is the truth? Why did his mother take a pistol out and murder his father?
Well, the short answer is we'll never know. I don't think exactly the answer. The circumstances are fascinating, but the answer for why it happened. I was just down in Georgia talking up the book last weekend, and there were some Cobb relatives down there who gave me conflicting accounts. That they heard over the dinner table when they were growing up, and they were related and right in the area. The circumstances were that Cobb's father was a amongst other things, he was the head of the school system in Franklin County, Georgia, there where they were growing up. And he said he was going on a trip. This was in August, the equivalent of a business trip, but with a horse-drawn wagon in those days. And this is 1905, to visit some schools in the summer, I guess, maybe, or when school was just starting up again. And he said he'd be gone from a Tuesday to a Thursday, but he came back Tuesday night, late around 11 o'clock at night, and his wife, who was in the house alone, said she heard a noise outside on the lawn and grabbed a pistol and fired through the window and wound up killing her husband. Now, there were rumors at the time that he thought that she was having an affair and other rumors that she knew very well who she was shooting, that she knew he was spying on her. So she was arrested and tried a few months later for manslaughter and was acquitted. But all this happened against the backdrop of Ty Cobb's rise from the minor leagues to the major leagues, and one of the first Southern players to really make that ascension. And this was in the days when the modern era of baseball was just beginning. 1901 was the year that the American League was formed, so then you had an American League and a National League and kind of the structure as we know it now. And baseball, it's we take a lot for granted, but we have to remember that baseball in the early 1900s was just in its infancy as a family entertainment. That is something that not just men would go to, that families would go to, and even women on their own would go to. Mm-hmm. And America was changing then. The movies were something that were still primitive, but they existed, and they were happening, and the movie stars were starting to emerge, and there were vaudeville stars. And along with that were the baseball players, who were also another form of star and celebrity. And Cobb was in that very first wave of, and he may have been, but, depending on how you look at it, the first baseball celebrity in America. So that's another consideration, I think, in his story, that he was kind of cutting his path through the forest as a celebrity, figuring out what it meant to be a celebrity in America. There right. were no precedents for it.
Yeah. Yeah, what a story. And he never spoke about his father's death?
Never once. It was a very, of course, shocking and also shameful thing. His mother had killed his father. He was 18 years old, and he had two younger siblings. And, you know, how do you act towards your mother when that happened?
Right.
Do you accept consolation from her? Do you console her herself? He's suddenly the man of the family. It was a very traumatic experience for him. And a couple of years, like a year and a half later, after being hazed by his teammates and the pressures of coming to the major leagues and the hazing and his mother's trial, and he had a nervous breakdown and disappeared in the middle of the season. So it had an effect on him.
Yeah. You write interestingly about that, too, that he was sent away. There were also some thoughts. You talk about his girlfriend at that time, and maybe he was at her bedside because she wasn't doing very well. But you fall on the side of he had a nervous breakdown and just had to be away from the game for a while and from everything.
Yeah, it's interesting how those things like a nervous breakdown weren't discussed in the paper in those days. It was, you know, there was kind of a shame to it to have problems like that, and he just disappeared. And he was the hottest young rookie in a way in baseball, the hottest young player, and his absence was not noted by the sports writers. So they must have been told, or you know, not to talk about it, not to mention it. And, you know, that was part of the different kind of America that he came up
mm-hmm.
in.
My family are all baseball people, and my husband's a baseball writer, so we have spent some time at our kitchen table talking about Ty Cobb, and it's no surprise to you that you're a sports guy as well, that for a long time he was thought of as a terrific baseball player, one of the best who ever lived, absolutely wonderful to watch, but also a racist thug who was despised by his opponents, who beat up people in the stands, who beat up black people. I mean, you had a vision of him being a horrible guy before you wrote the book, right?
Yeah, I say somewhere in the files of Simon & Schuster, the publisher, is a proposal that I wrote for a book that I never executed. Because I went into the project thinking he was that. And one of the first things I realized was that his reputation, he was always thought of as a hard player, a hard-nosed player, and a very, and some said even a dirty player in his day. But that was usually the out-of-town sports writers who said that. The real reputation as a monster and a racist and misogynist and all those other things you mentioned, that didn't really come about until after he died in 1961, and based on no new evidence. So that's the curious thing about this, the Ty Cobb story, is that it took this turn in 1961 after he died, with the help of one hack sports writer who I like to say started a snowball rolling, and it became an avalanche of lies, if that doesn't sound too dramatic, but that's kind of what happened. And it's a fascinating study in mass psychology in itself, why people love that story and of the fake story of Ty Cobb. They like the myth so much that they cling to it very steadfastly.
Mm-hmm. You describe what baseball players were like. I found it interesting that there were some hotels that wouldn't allow any ball players to be staying in those hotels because they were thought of as a bunch of ruffians?
Yeah, and to some degree they lived up to their reputation. Cobb, I should say, was no saint, and I don't paint him as a saint in this book. My allegiance was not really to Ty Cobb, it was to the truth. So I try to paint him, tell the truth as it was. And he was a guy, baseball players fought a lot in those days with each other physically. I think people did, men, of course, mostly, but threw their fists a lot quicker in those days and got to that point. But even in that milieu, he stood out as someone who fought a lot. The other interesting thing about baseball players in the early 20th century was that, as I say, they weren't yet thought of as celebrities. They certainly weren't rich, and they were more like carnies, you know, than celebrities. They were guys who were they drank a lot. they had taken up this line of work that was sort of semi-respectable, and they were actually making less as ballplayers than 25, 26, 27-year-old men would make, you know, on the other side. They were making less than their, you know, age equivalent person in the stands. So it was a different era, and those guys were very rough around the edges.
Yeah. And he sure didn't want to be disrespected, did he?
No, he had this Southern thing. He himself wasn't. He stood out, and this one reason he was such a cause of dissension and a lightning rod. He had his father, he was very upper middle class in his bringing. He didn't go to college, but his father did, and his father was, apart from being an educator and a supervisor of the school system, he was a newspaper editor and a state senator. So Cobb came from he had a sort of a Southern aristocratic air about him, and some thought that he acted as if he was better than the other guys, and he may have actually thought that himself. So he had that genteel quality, but as I say in the book, he wavered between that and the kind of Southern cavalier attitude, the guy who's quick to draw his sword and get in a fight. And he never quite resolved which he was, whether he was the Southern gentleman or the Southern cavalier, and he went back and forth between those two roles his whole life.
Mm-hmm. He liked Les Miserables.
He did. That was his favorite book. He was a constant reader, and he was actually, you know, liked by fans loved to boo him, but they actually liked him. Out of town fans, the fans in Chicago, voted him the most popular out of town player. He would often be presented with books, a package of books at home plate before the game. You know, when they were honoring people in those days, they gave ballplayers, it's kind of fun to read flowers a lot, bouquets of flowers and horseshoes of flowers when they honored them, the great players when they came to visiting parks. He was such a reader that he once, when he was negotiating a new contract, he said there were two reasons he thought he deserved more money. One was that his window of opportunity to earn money as an athlete was very small, so he had to make it while he could. The other reason was that he had to give up novels because he couldn't read too much, and the strain on his eyes would hurt his batting average. And I say, you know, he's probably the first and last ballplayer ever to complain that he had to give up reading novels.
That's great. So what was it about him just as a player that made him, the picture on the front of your book is beautiful. He does look like a dancer, really.
That he made like Fred Astaire to me. Yeah, it's funny you should
Fred
say
Astaire.
That. Yeah.
Oh, I've just been into Fred Astaire watching movies of him. You're right. He does have that kind of look about him. So what was it that made him stand out? What did he do other players didn't do?
Well, I think this is it's a good question because it's what we miss by not having film of him. There's very little, almost no film, just a few seconds here and a few seconds there, and almost nothing at all of him on the bases in a regular game. He was, when you read the accounts, the hundreds and hundreds of stories that were written about him, he was the most exciting player of his time. And, you know, everyone can look at his numbers, and his numbers are astounding. His batting average was .366, was the highest average of his day, and it's still the record for batting average. And that was over 23 and a half seasons. I mean, there were years when he batted over .400. He batted .420 one year. And he stole home plate 54 times, and that's still a record. And he set 90 records in his day when he retired. But the numbers really don't tell the whole story because he was such an exciting player. Someone once said that watching Babe Ruth hit a home run was not as exciting as watching Ty Cobb get a walk, because when Ruth hit that home run, it started and ended in an instant, and it was exciting. But when Cobb got on first base, then the fun just began, because he would scratch and claw and trick his way around the bases. You know, he once stole second, third, and home on three consecutive pitches.
Oh my goodness.
And he once hit an inside the park home run on a tap back to the pitcher's mound. And he didn't even slide when he scored. I can tell you how that happened. But so he was an amazing ball player to watch. He was always out there moving around on the bases, being a disruptive force. He always said he had a philosophy of baseball that he said he wanted to be a mental hazard to the other team. And he wanted to be disrupted. Now, today that sounds like, okay, I understand that. A lot of people are in sports. That's part of sports. But in the early 20th century, that was kind of a controversial thing to be. It was considered ungentlemanly, unsportsmanlike to be a mental hazard to the other guy, you know, by some people, by the old school people. Well, so that was one reason he got in. He was controversial.
All right. Well, what about being a physical hazard to the other guy? The stories, of course, have gone on and on for years that he filed his spike so that he could, you know, cause harm to other players. Did he do that, or did he not?
He didn't. The spike sharpening story I found was a story, sort of a myth that was applied to different people going back. I traced it back as far as the 1880s. You know, and you know, Cobb was only born in 1885 and came up to the major leagues in 1905. So that was a story that got stuck to different people. It got stuck to Cobb and it stayed stuck. You know, the sports writers and the out of town fans were the ones who liked that myth about Ty Cobb coming in high with his spikes. The other players, almost to a man, that I found, and if you look there, chapter 17 of my book is filled with quotes from other players, from rivals, from teammates, even guys he didn't get along with, even from umpires, saying they never saw him use his spikes in a vicious way. You know, it was interesting, the public in early 1900s who was sitting in the ballpark, these are people that didn't grow up playing organized baseball. They didn't play scholastic sports. They had no first-hand experience with spikes. Spikes to them were some exotic sort of semi, you know, Jules Verne-ish, sci-fi, and, you know, medieval at the same time. They were fascinated by them. And I found articles in the paper where people thought people were going to get killed with spikes. Of course, it's much easier to kill someone with a ball or a bat. So they had a fascination with them. But the ball players, to a man, said, you know, that's what the civilians think. Cobb doesn't do that. And if you look at the testaments and testimony in my book, no one ever really accused him of that seriously. You know, in the heat of the moment, they might. Now, having said that, there was this, he called it my patch. It was a right of way question. He believed the base runner had the right of way to slide, you know, into the base. And if you wanted to stick your hand or your leg in there, you did that on your watch, as they said in those days. And so people did get hurt, not just by him, but by, you know, other players. And Cobb himself once rolled up his pants in the 50s and showed a sports writer his legs, which were a mass of scar tissue. And he said, this is what I got from the guys who came down, the infielders and the catchers who came down on me with their spikes. And he wasn't complaining. He was just pointing out that's the way the game was played in those days.
Mm-hmm. We'll take phone calls. We're talking with the author of Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. Charles Learson is our guest, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter, @KDunnShow. The other thought about Ty Cobb was that he was a racist, and our guest writes that Cobb himself left very little evidence of his feelings on the issue prior to the advent of Jackie Robinson, but he did leave some. And we will be talking about the assault on Fred Collins, which is one of the cornerstones of the argument that Cobb was a racist. So we'll hear about that episode and others, and welcome your phone calls and carry on momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, two phone calls. Scott, our baseball fan in La Crosse. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Let me tie your 2 hours together. Further evidence of your brilliance is booking this gentleman to talk about baseball.
Stop. But baseball is a sport for intelligent people, don't you think, Scott?
Oh, how could I think anything else, given the circumstances?
No, absolutely.
What I'd like to ask the guest about is, this is, actually, while waiting on the phone here, I went online, and just because I told KP when I called, I remember this incident of reading about a biography of Cobb, but I wanted to research it a little bit more. And this is from an ESPN publication on gambling and baseball. And it's about the incident. The quote here is, Ty Cobb and Tris Speaker were permitted by Ban Johnson, who was American League president at the time, to resign from baseball near the end of the 1926 season after former pitcher Dutch Leonard charged that Cobb, Speaker, and Smokey Joe Wood, all Hall of Famers, had joined him just before the 1919 World Series in betting on a game they all knew was fixed. And this supposedly went to the new commissioner of baseball, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who finally said it was okay, nothing had really happened. But I was wondering if your guest in his research found any gambling-type issues or anything like that involving Ty Cobb?
Well, yeah. I mean, I want to say again, if I haven't said already, that my book is I have an allegiance to the truth, not to Ty Cobb. So I try to tell the story, you know, warts and all, whatever I found in each episode. The gambling story of 1926 is sort of a gray area, I think, ultimately. I mean, what happened was Dutch Leonard, who you mentioned, who had a gripe against both Ty Cobb and Tris Speaker. Tris Speaker was another great ball player of that era. And Dutch Leonard was, if you think Ty Cobb was hard to get along with and unpopular, you should see what they said about Dutch Leonard. His Dutch Leonard's manager once suspended him just for being the way he was, he said, not for any particular violation.
Oh, my gosh.
So he was that kind of guy. So Leonard emerged after being out of baseball for a while with these letters and an accusation. And apparently what had happened in 1919, like 5 years or 7 years before that, was that at the end of the season, in a meaningless game, the Indians who were managed by Tris Speaker and who Speaker played, was a player manager, their season was over. They couldn't move up or down. The Tigers, if they won the next game and they were playing the Indians, could get into third place and get a share of the postseason money. So supposedly this conversation went on where they said, okay, Tris Speaker said, we'll let you win, and then and so you can get in and get the postseason money that will let the Tigers win. And then someone said, well, as long as we know what's going to happen, we might as well try to get a bet down on the game. At that point, they had a hard time getting a bet down because the bookmaker didn't want to take the money. It's all kind of complicated. Cobb and Speaker at that point, apparently, it seems they dropped out of the proposition and didn't participate. The other guys you mentioned, there were a couple of Smokey Joe Wood and there were one or two others did. But the results are very hard to figure because Cobb was supposed to be on the winning team, and he went 0 for 4 that day, or 0 for 5. And Tris Speaker was supposed to be on the losing team, went like 4 for 5 at the plate. So it's a little bit, a little bit of a head scratcher. But as you say, in the end, they were exonerated by the commissioner of baseball. So, you know, that's all we know. They may have gotten, in the beginning, they may have been in a conversation they really shouldn't have been in and suggested something, but then they seem to have dropped out along the way.
Hmm. Well, it sounds like a fascinating book. I'm really looking forward to it.
You'll like it, Scott. Yeah, it's well done. Thank you so much for the call. All right, let's talk about racism. His assault on Fred Collins, you write in the book, it's one of the cornerstones of the often advanced argument that Cobb was a full-throttle racist. This attack taking place broad daylight outside a downtown hotel before 200 witnesses. What happened?
Well, apparently what happened was that Fred Collins was a worker for the city of Detroit, and he was involved in an operation where they're putting asphalt down on the street, and he was at times he had to hold up the traffic. They were asked people not to walk in certain places, and Cobb and a bunch of players were coming out of the Pontchartrain Hotel there in Detroit and getting on the bus to go to the stadium, and he held up his hand, he said something. Cobb, very characteristically, took offense. You had to be very careful the way you spoke to him. And the two wound up fighting and rolling around in the wet asphalt in the street. Now, you know, it's been said Cobb did that because he was a racist, because he was born in Georgia in 1886. It's very hard to tell. The newspaper reported that Cobb used the N-word at some point. They were fighting. Cobb got, as I say, got in a lot of fights. He got in fights with two or three people that were black in his life. He got in fights with many more people that were white. And he was often in fights with the kind of person that Fred Collins represented. In other words, a service worker or a city worker who was telling him to do something that he didn't care to do. You know, we don't really know. We can't read Cobb's mind how much that played into it. You know, on the subject of race, though. Most of Cobb, you know, most of what's said about Cobb and race can be traced back to a 1984 book by Charles Alexander. It's a pretty good book otherwise, but Alexander made some big mistakes in that he misidentified as black several of the white people that Cobb fought with. Now, Fred Collins was black and Cobb fought with him. But some of the other key fights that Cobb had with a butcher, with two guys in a hotel in Cleveland, with a butcher in Detroit, those guys, they weren't black. People jumped to made assumptions, let me say that, because Cobb was born in 1886 in Georgia. But what they don't consider is that Cobb descended from a long line of abolitionists, that his great-grandfather was a preacher who preached against slavery and got run out of town for it. His grandfather was refused to fight in the Confederate Army because of the slavery issue. And his father was, amongst other things, a state senator who stood up for his black constituents and broke up a lynch mob around town. Now, Cobb never said anything about race for the record. No one asked him until 1952, when he was asked about the integration of the Texas League, the minor league, and he said the Negro should be accepted into baseball wholeheartedly and not grudgingly. The Negro has the right to play professional baseball, and who's to say he has not? That's Cobb's first statement on race. And in the interim, he'd been attending Negro League games. He sat in the dugout with the players. He threw out the first ball once at a Negro League game, at least once. So, you know, those are the facts and those are the statements. You know, a couple of fights here and there with a man who had so many fights. You know, that we can only guess what was going on in Cobb's mind, but we know what he said and we know what he did. And so I think you get a very different picture, and you know, a much better picture of him from the facts and of the matter. You know?
Let's talk more about some of these fights. You know, these things, to me, they're disgusting. This thing that you talk about, Ed Seaver, is that his name? The pitcher who says some bad thing about Cobb, who evidently had very thin skin, so he knocks him and hurts his jaw, and then he walks by him and kicks him in the face. And then we've got this. Hey, tell me more about this, because this seems to be one of the more disturbing incidents. This report of a guy named George Lucker who was heckling Cobb from the bleachers that took place in New York. Cobb goes into the stands. Lucker had three fingers on one hand, none on the other, and he beat him. Is that a true story? And what about this fight? Well, that is a true story. So isn't that an indication that this guy was really a bad apple? That's a bad thing to do.
Well, yeah, it certainly is. You know, Claude Lucker, what I found out, which hasn't really been reported before, he'd been harassing Cobb for a year. Cobb didn't know about his lack of fingers. He was harassing Cobb from the stands for a year. He was a fellow Southerner who actually grew up not far from where Cobb grew up, and had been calling Cobb names. Cobb had several times called out to him saying, "Look, I'm just trying to earn a living down here. Will you get off my back?" And the guy continued to call him names. And the day of the Cobb charge into the stands, Lucker, it was his fourth day in a row that he'd been at the stadium in New York and saying the things he was saying. Cobb went to the management. He tried to find someone to go into the stands and tell the guy to shut up. Then finally he lost his temper, ran in there and beat him up. Now there's no, you know, those are the facts, you know, good and bad, and mostly it's bad. That did happen. Fan abuse was a big issue in 1912 when that happened. And when Cobb was suspended for beating that man up by the president of the American League, his fellow players went on strike in support of him because there had been so much abuse by fans. You know, one of the things that about baseball being new as a big-time entertainment was that everyone was trying to figure out what the etiquette and the protocols were. The fans were constantly jumping onto the field and chasing the umpires around. The players were getting in physical fights on the field a lot. People were working out how you should act at a ballpark and what it meant to be at a ballpark. And the fans were extremely abusive of the players in those days. And the fact that Cobb's teammates went on strike in support of him was the first strike in Major League Baseball history. Flies in the face of the myth that his teammates disliked him. Every one of his teammates disliked him. So that's the story. You know, if you have all the pixels in the photograph, it looks a little different, I think, than if you just say, oh, he went into the stands and beat up a handicapped man. But it's still at the, you know, at the end of the story, he did do that, and he was no saint. You know, as far as his teammate, that fight, that came at the end of a year of harassment on, and bullying and hazing, vicious sometimes, where his clothes and his personal property were destroyed. He was ostracized. His bats were sawed in half. He was locked out of the bathroom in the hotels where he went and beaten up by one of the catcher on the team, was sort of the appointed thug and bully who would cold cock Cobb when he came around the corner and just punch him in the face. So if you know that, then his finally erupting and beating up that guy perhaps looks a little bit different. But yes, that happened, and he kicked the guy in the face, I believe, after he was down and unconscious. But he was one of the hazers and one of the bulliers. So, you know, that's the full story, and you have to just kind of, you know, judge it for yourself.
Right. And obviously, all of these teams and these people were in need of anger management classes, which we know about now. But you would have thought that somebody would have said, wait a second, this is no way to behave as a human being. Didn't anybody do that in baseball or sort of question what the way to get around in life was? And it's to defend your honor and to fight somebody who's going to call you a bad name?
The world was changing. But it was still to the point where I found evidence, and there's a section in the book, if you remember, that I talked about how the world was different, and even child psychologists were recommending that boys get in fights, you know, that a healthy boy got in fights two or three times a week, and that was good for his system somehow, or it's good for his psychology. So it was a different kind of world, and brutal hazing was chuckled at sometimes, you know, you know, it was supposed to have made you a man. It was also a time when people were coming together from different parts of the country. You know, the world was changing. People were moving off their farms. The big corporate farms were moving in and buying up the family farms, and everyone was migrating from the farm to the city. People from different areas were being thrown together, and no more so than in baseball, where the business of baseball brought Southerners in with Northerners and Protestants in with Catholics and Jews, and very often these guys clashed, you know, just because of their religious, ethnic, geographic differences.
Yeah. But isn't it interesting, Charles, and you went to some trouble. I know the book is incredibly well researched, but you cite his father, W.H. Cobb, writing a letter to his son, Ty, and telling him when he was 15 years old to conquer your anger and wild passions that would degrade your dignity and belittle your manhood.
That's right. From his childhood, you know, I'm not trying to whitewash Cobb. From his childhood, he was very quick and often definitely too quick to fly off the handle, mm-hmm. and to go from, you know, a perceived slight, which may not have even been a slight, to throwing his fist. People always said he didn't start a fight, but he had an exquisitely short fuse, mm-hmm. That he very often got into one. So he was in a way typical of his time, but only more so.
Yeah. How did he happen to stumble upon baseball?
Well, he was just fascinated from the start. A lot of people were, you know, baseball was taking root in America then. It was a tremendously popular thing. You know, sports was becoming, the world was changing, as I say. The world was ready for a lot of reasons. The rise of unions and the second industrial revolution, as we learned about it in school, was ready for mass entertainment. And the sport of baseball was coming along, and it fascinated people. And he started out when he was a kid. He just had this fascination with throwing even rocks up in the air and hitting them with sticks. And it went on from there, and he had a talent for it, and he also had that intelligence that he applied towards, you know, making himself better and figuring out strategies and ways and, you know, figuring out how it was done. As you know, baseball is an endlessly fascinating sport, and it's if you're an intelligent person, it's there as a puzzle to be solved and wrestled with all the time.
Hmm. Hmm. And what did his father think about his playing? His father was educated, superintendent. Didn't he want him to be a teacher or something?
Yes, he did. He wanted him to be a teacher or a lawyer. He wanted him to go to one of the military academies. As Cobb himself said, he's never read a baseball biography in which the father didn't want, you know, in his day, didn't want the kid to become a baseball player, because it always meant you were kind of like making less than you could otherwise, and you were pursuing this career that at some point was going to end, and you'd be 32 years old or whatever, and you know, and not, and you wouldn't have started down the road to anything. So you know, in the beginning, it you know, his father, you know, it was always a brand new thing to be getting money to play
right.
a game.
Right.
You know, and that, and some of the fathers who'd come up in the, you know, Cobb's father was born during the Civil War, so that was a hard notion for him to wrestle with. But he eventually came around and supported Ty to the extent that he didn't live to see him, you know, become a major leaguer, though.
Hmm. And by money, what are you talking? How much money?
Oh, you know, I think Cobb made $1,400 in his first season for the whole season, and you know, that wasn't very much. The funny thing I found when I did the research was that baseball players, not Cobb, but almost everyone else on the team, they had what they call a sobriety clause in their contract. So they'd be offered $1,400 and $1,600 if they stayed sober the whole season. And they'd get the other $200 at the end of the season. Alcohol and drinking was a huge problem in baseball at that time, and that wasn't a separate issue exactly from the fights. A lot of the brawls were drunken brawls that took place in baseball.
We welcome more phone calls if you'd like to join our conversation. We're talking about Ty Cobb this hour with the author of Charles Learson is the author of Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. And he, as you heard him say, he had this idea to write a book about Ty Cobb. It had been a while since anybody had written about him. And when he investigated, and he spent, I think, 4 years doing research, talking to people who knew him, poring over newspaper articles, he came up with, not a saint by any means, but perhaps some of the stories about him that were circulated by many for a long period of time were not completely true. So how do you find the truth about Ty Cobb? And it's also an interesting look at, well, his family background is fascinating. A look at baseball and gives you a sense of turn-of-the-century life in America, which was kind of rough and tumble. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We are on Facebook at The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can find us on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, two phone calls now. 800-486-8655 is our number. Charles Learson is our guest, and Jim in Rice Lake, our first caller. Hi, Jim.
I just had a quick question. I can't remember the name of the movie, but there was a famous Ty Cobb movie made about 5 or 6 years ago with a very successful male leading actor whose name escapes me. I think he was Al Gore's Harvard roommate. He's made other movies.
Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah, exactly. And I just want to, that my personal impression of Ty Cobb is from that movie. And it was, I think he would get a very, I don't know how accurate, but a very riveting performance. And I just wanted for you to comment on how accurate or appropriate you thought that movie was, because I think for a lot of people, I think that is probably one of the most effective or leading impressions of Ty Cobb. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks. Well, I think you're right about that. You know, the movie itself was a financial bomb, and it only played in the theaters for about a week, but because it lives on, you know, DVDs and Netflix and whatnot. That movie was based on the work of that sports writer that I mentioned before, Al Stump, who was completely dishonest and not only made up facts about Cobb, but forged Cobb's autograph and sold it and created fake Cobb memorabilia that he sold and that wound up in the Hall of Fame, and the FBI had investigated and take it out of the Hall of Fame. But that Ron Shelton, the filmmaker, who's made some great sports films, made that film, and I interviewed him when I was doing research for my book, and there's one scene in there where Cobb attempts to rape a cigarette girl at a Nevada casino, and he fails because he's a drunken drug addict or something. And I said, where'd you get that scene from? Yeah, where did that happen? I'd never heard that before. He said, well, that's something we made up on the set because it seemed like the kind of thing Ty Cobb would do. You know, so that's, you know, that's typical Hollywood when it comes to, you know, true stories, you know, based on a true story. That's what they do. They, you know, if you didn't have a wife, they'll give you a pretty wife. And if they didn't, you know, they just move the facts around like furniture. And so that's the kind of movie that was, because it was a completely dishonest movie based on, you know, on lies and on the work of someone who's been completely discredited, the writer Al Stump, who actually has a cameo appearance in the movie. Was
oh,
made
does he?
Before he
well,
died.
Why
yeah.
would he do that? Well, what's in it for him to make up lies?
Money, you know, just like the forging of the autographs and selling, and the, you know, he came up with a saleable story. I don't think Stump was that smart, but he stumbled on this idea of this monster, you know, of creating this myth, and the myth sort of fit well with the idea of the very intense, pugnacious, you know, Ty Cobb that was real, and it sort of it sat nicely on that. But he just took that and extrapolated from that and made him a monster and a murderer and a drug addict, you know, crazy man waving around guns, and then people took that and embroidered on it and retold it. And as I say, the other author added a layer of racism, which Stump himself didn't add, and then the internet came along and allowed us to like supercharge all the lies and pass them around, and then we have the myth of today, and Cobb isn't around to defend himself, and you know, no one else has gone back to the historical record to really say, wait a minute, that's not what happened. You know, it's a story that's found so much traction that
yes,
I can't really explain it, but I know because people still want to cling to it. They don't want to hear the truth in some cases.
Yeah, well, and it also may be that because he was far from being a saint, some of what he did, you know, lends to exaggerating what he did because he wasn't,
exactly.
You know, he did some bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Harry in Winona, Minnesota. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
All right, you.
Good. I'm doing great. I was listening down the conversation. Very interesting. This kind of actually tags along with the other question. How did the other players treat him? Did they respect him? And, you know, as his hits were accumulating back then, did he get a pass, or were they really out, you know, to get him, to shut him down?
No, I think, you know, because, you know, if you look at the testimony of what the players said, opponents and even guys on the team, you know, he didn't get along with everyone the same way or get along equally well. But there was a guy on the team named Sam Crawford, a famous ball player, is also in the Hall of Fame. And Cobb helped him get in the Hall of Fame, actually, as on the Veterans Committee in the 1950s, decades later. But they didn't get along very well. And Crawford said, you know, he didn't use his spikes the wrong way. He didn't slide into people. He had friends, you know, usually when you're a writer, you argue for how extraordinary your subject is. On the matter of friendships, his were more ordinary. But you have to remember, having said that he was this celebrity, and a celebrity was a new thing in America then. And people were, his teammates too, had to figure out how to adjust to acting with this guy who, as time went on, made considerably more money than they did, who was treated very differently than they were. I mean, they played in Washington one time, and you know, they played it after the game. President Taft shook all their hands. Cobb, he gave a big hug to, you know, and invited him to his summer home. You know, so there was that kind of treatment. An old ball player who was played in the generation after Cobb said to me, and you have to understand, Cobb was like the first DiMaggio or the first Ted Williams, and he was on that other level. He was treated differently, and if you didn't reconcile yourself to that as a fellow, as a teammate, you were kind of you know, you weren't going to get along with him. But if you understood that, you know, things were fine.
Thanks, Harry, for your call. Al, Land Lakes. Hi.
Hi. Hi. Perfect show. I'm a fan. Two parts. The first part is I've often heard stories about Ty Cobb being in a ground floor investor in Coca-Cola, and I wondered what the story was on that. And the second part, I would become a Buddhist if he could be reincarnated and play for the Brewers.
Yeah, well, he wouldn't be too happy with the Brewers.
No,
this year,
he wouldn't be.
But a lot of those Tiger teams he was on weren't much better, actually. They only won the World, you know, played in the World Series three times in his 23 and a half year career, and they never won it. But, yeah, he did make most of his money off the field. He knew Woodruff, the Coca-Cola heir. He hunted with him, and you know, he tipped him off and said, "Well, buy this Coca-Cola stock back when it was, you know, when it wasn't such an obvious thing, and hang on to it." And Cobb did that. He also bought General Motors stock and did that. He tried to tell the sports writers to do the same thing, but you know, most of them didn't listen to him. He was probably worth about $7 million when he died in 1961. So
fair amount.
Not so bad.
Yeah. Well, as I recall, I lived in Georgia for a while. Coca-Cola was discovered, and I think I've seen the house in Villarica, Georgia. So maybe he knew.
Yeah,
he knew all those people.
He did, yeah. He traveled in pretty high-class circles, Cobb. Presidents and corporate executives, and you know, that was his style.
Ellen in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I am thinking as I'm listening that what I was going to talk about was your commentary on the meanness, or what I'll call the meanness of the times, the more cruel way people treated each other, at least according to my mom and dad's stories. They grew up, or they lived on the south side of Milwaukee, and I heard stories as I was growing up, and my mom would just say, people were mean then. She saw a man who didn't like the cowlick on the top of a boy's head take his cigar and put it out, you know,
on the top of the head.
And everyone laughed, you know.
Charles.
Yeah. It was a Hobbesian world, as we say. You know, if you were born around the turn of the century, your life expectancy was about 40, you know, then. So it was still a tough world. In a lot of ways, the world was changing from the Middle Ages still into the modern way. Like I say, we were getting into mass entertainment and getting women, the rise of women. The women were in the workforce, and they were getting the vote, fighting for the vote anyway in the early years of the 20th century. And, you know, the world was changing and getting more like we know it now, but it still wasn't there yet.
Mm-hmm. From what did Ty Cobb die?
From what?
How did he die?
He died. He had several things. Cancer, I guess, was the ultimate thing. He had diabetes and several other problems. He was in his mid 70s in 1961. It was a slow, kind of hard death in the hospital in Georgia. But you know, one of the myths is that he had a bag of money with $1 million and a gun on it in his hospital room when he died. And I talked to a quite elderly doctor now who was a medical student then and took care of Cobb, was Cobb's private nurse at the end. And he said that bag of money, the gun, it was all made up by the same guy who made up all the rest, Al Stump. You know, to make a better story and a more sensational story.
Unless that guy took the money, right, Charles? Then we got even another story. We got about a minute left. Wayne in Brookfield. Hi.
Hi. I guess Cobb was kind of boisterous, and he was at a luncheon, and there was a fellow named Hicks at the luncheon, and Cobb says to Hicks, he says, "You know what we do with Hicks in New York?" And the Hicks from Kentucky says, "I don't know, but I know what we do with Cobbs in Kentucky." And I guess it's one of the few times that Cobb didn't have a word to say.
You know that story, Charles?
No, first time I heard it.
Yeah, you bet there are a lot of stories you hear for the first time. So you really researched the heck out of this. You spent years on this, didn't you? Poring over newspaper articles?
Yeah, almost 4 years. Newspapers,
wow.
The personal letters by Cobb and to Cobb and historical documents. It's the first time, you know, it's not anything that they were like secret papers out there, but if you wanted to expend the energy and use the time, you could find the truth, you know, and I hope I came close to it.
Yeah. Well, you must love baseball, too, and would have loved to have seen this guy play the game.
Yeah, like I say, the most exciting player of all time, you know, in my opinion, you know, if not just the best overall.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with us. You're a lovely writer as well. Thanks.
Oh, thanks so much, Kathleen.
Charles Learson, and the book is Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. Charles is the author of other books, Blood and Smoke, A True Tale of Mystery, Mayhem, and the Birth of the Indy 500, and Crazy Good, The True Story of Dan Patch, the Most Famous Horse in America. He's written for Sports Illustrated, Esquire, Rolling Stone, Newsweek, New York Times Magazine, and other magazines as well. So we thank him very much for being with us. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the show and on-air production. Thanks to Scotty Myers as well. Great conversations ahead. I'll look forward to seeing many of you tonight at the Literacy Council of Greater Waukesha's 23rd Annual Corporate Spelling Bee. We'll watch businesses and organizations from Waukesha County compete against each other. Should be fun. And I'll be with you again Monday.